Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, although there's no Amy today. She's feeling a bit under the weather, so I'm flying solo. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line is the call-in number, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Illinois, as a state, is sort of turning into Northwestern, my alma mater. Every time it's in the news, when it comes to Northwestern, the value of my degree declines. Every time Illinois is in the news, it seems the level of our embarrassment increases. Correlative. So we're the subject, our state, our schools, the subject of a Wall Street Journal editorial. We were talking about the topic a bit yesterday with Ted Zebrowski from Wire Points. And that's included in what the Wall Street Journal addresses. We aren't often speechless, but the extent to which Illinois school performance is betraying a generation of school children is hard to put into words. Yeah. But you can put it into some data points that speak to it. Oh, and by the way, note the date, the year in which the numbers you're about to hear were recorded. 2019, pre-pandemic. So it's more likely than not that the numbers you're about to hear have gotten worse in the intervening 3 years, given kids being out of school for so much of that time, right? In 2019, 36% of all third grade students could read at grade level. This isn't CPS. This isn't some school district that is known to fail its students generation after generation. I guess unless you consider the entire Illinois K through 12 system to fit that description, which one could argue. This is statewide. Two-thirds of third grade students do not read at grade level. That's an F. And that's the good news. That number drops to 27% can read at grade level for Hispanics. 36% all overall. So a little bit better than 1 in 3. A little bit better than 1 in 4 for Latino students. And a little bit better than 1 in 5, 22% for Black students. And as you heard on the show, one of the most shocking reports that we've delivered to you in places like Decatur, and specifically Decatur, 2%. 2% of Black third graders are reading at grade level. 1% are doing math at grade level. These are the sort of numbers where I revisit the contention that if you shut down these school systems, the numbers couldn't be worse. Because you're going to have that percentage, certainly above 1 in 2% indicator, you're going to have that percentage of parents that are so hyper-engaged and hyper-focused on their kids' education that these kids that are at least at grade level now, proficient in reading and math now, would be proficient in reading no matter what the circumstances were because the parents wouldn't allow anything less. So, for example, in CPS, the $9 billion we spend collectively, and the multiple of that we spend statewide, 36% of third grade students overall, 27 Latino, 22 Black. Rockford, It's not just Decatur. Rockford, 7% of black third graders in Rockford were reading at grade level. 11% Latino third graders. In Elgin, U46, another school district that if you shut it down, you could hardly do worse. 8% of black, in Elgin, 7% of black third graders in Rockford reading grade level. 11% of Hispanic third graders in Elgin, grade level. 8% of black third graders in Peoria. How bad are these numbers in these mid-sized urban areas? Chicago is at 30. I mean, that's obviously nothing to cheer. That's dismal. Two in Decatur. Seven in Blackford and in Rockford, the black third graders. And in Elgin, which is the preponderant minority is Latinos, 11%. A child who can't read in fifth grade can't do word problems in fourth or science experiments in fifth. So what's the good of promoting them? Well, somebody else's problem. And of course, what we were talking about with Dabrowski from Wire Points yesterday is the chasm between those numbers and the proficiency ratings of the teachers in these districts. In Decatur, 97.3% of teachers were rated excellent or proficient. 97.3% of teachers are rated excellent proficient in a school district where 2% of black third graders are reading grade level and 1% are doing math at grade level. How's that possible? In Chicago, they Don Larson'd it. Perfect game. 100%. 100% of teachers were rated proficient or excellent. 100% of 25,000 teachers. Again, I'm sure most of the teachers are great teachers in a lot of these school districts. Certainly a lot of them are. It's not to say that good teachers are not trying to ply their trade in difficult circumstances. But 100%? No one. No one failed to meet the standards in CPS. 97.3 indicator with those statistics. And on down the line. As the Wall Street Journal notes, obvious, because I know where people say, well, what can you do with certain kids in certain familial situations? Yeah, it's true. There's no question. The biggest influence on a child's intellectual, social, emotional development is family, which is why we should be a little bit more guarded about government interventions between parents and children. But as they know, family and social dysfunction play some role in this scandal, but the overriding problem is school governance and the monopoly power of the teachers' unions. The teachers' union, like CTU, which has long been run by Marxists and has walked out four times in the last 7 years. Where are we now? $30,000 per student in CPS. Teachers get raises, schools get more money, and children are shuffled through until it's time for the adults to collect a pension. Yeah, that's the way we do it. And this is the results that produces. You know, we talk about civilization being on the ballot on November 8th with respect to law and order, personal safety. Well, civilization is on the ballot, too, with respect to our K-12 school systems. Because if you think these are numbers that will not negatively impact the level of civilization that we enjoy in Chicago land and Illinois, then I think you're in for a surprise. Nick, on the northwest side.
Yeah, thank you. You moved me around a little bit. Yeah, Dan, you know what's going on. Thank you. over the decades, the teachers' unions have made one thing clear, that when it comes to their paid or benefits and their retirement plans, they do a very good job of that. And I'm not criticizing every single teacher, of course, and just like you don't, but they got that clear pattern that if they just can't teach the kids somehow, some way, the numbers look good, they pass the kids one grade then up to the other. And this is where this mess is at now, and it's really bad. And again, you know what's going on. Thank you, man.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Well, it's one of those things, too, where, you know, I understand you're in this a Polypiro-style system. And I understand that there's a lot of good teachers, and you will hear from people. Well, my, you know, relative is a teacher in this school district, and she's at her wit's end, and so on and so forth. I find it surprising and sad that you don't hear more from teachers inside the system. Why not more whistleblowers? Why don't you have more people telling you what's going on from the inside, being very public, as opposed to, you know, having people have to pry information out of these systems so we can tell you from the outside what's going on? I mean, I assume parents have some idea, but, you know, it's limited. Those, some of those internal deliberations in the faculty lounge or at the union meeting, boy, they'd be interesting to hear, wouldn't they? Strip away the veneer of we're doing everything that we do for the kids when the results say otherwise. Have some more teachers come out and support, publicly support the Opportunity Scholarship Program so we can build upon the 120,000 students that have left CPS over the past two decades and the thousands that are leaving each and every year. What was it, another 8,000 that got out this year? This seems to me the question that bedevils Illinois. Do we have enough people that are really willing to put in the fight for what they know to be true? Do we have enough people in Illinois that are willing to say something when they see something? And I'm not talking about COVID mitigation compliance. I'm talking about, you know, when you see people robbing children of their future. That's an occasion to say something, too. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. As I mentioned, Amy is under the weather, so she's off today. Hopefully be back tomorrow. Remembering Olga Maria Calderon, name ring a bell to you? Yeah, it probably does to people listening to the show, follow what's going on in Chicago. Olga Maria Calderon was the Walgreens clerk that was stabbed to death while she was at work at that Walgreens in Wicker Park a couple of years ago. The story, 9:30 a.m. on September 6th. Of 2020. She reported for work. Prosecutor said Calderon, 32, was stocking shelves at the Walgreens in Wicker Park when an 18-year-old walked up to her, grabbed her in a possible robbery attempt, and brutally stabbed her to death. The assailant in the case, the man who murdered Ms. Calderon, was recently taken off of electronic monitoring for a separate burglary charge earlier in the year, when he was 17, technically a juvenile. Then in May, he was arrested shortly after breaking into a Melrose Park gun store and grabbing 14 handguns. That was an interesting factoid in this case, maybe triggering your memory now, pun intended. He was charged as a juvenile. In August, the gun store owner was notified that this guy had violated the conditions of his electronic monitoring, but the court ordered that his monitoring bracelet be removed, and the Cook County State's attorneys offered no objection. So it was, and then he went to rob a Walgreens, and he murdered Olga Maria Calderon. The family at the time wanted to know. They had some questions, as you might imagine. Why would the state's attorney, this is quoting, why would the state's attorney allow a person who robbed a gun store be allowed to walk free to commit other crimes? If it's because he's a schizophrenic, as reported in the news, then why wasn't he required to be electronically monitored while getting the necessary medical and psychological treatment? Two minor children no longer have a mother to kiss, hug, and love. This brutal could and should have been prevented. Should it have been? Could it have been? Well, by who? Not by Tim Dart. Excuse me, Tom Dart, the sheriff, brother Tim. I always confuse the two. What's the difference, really? Brother Tim's a lobbyist. Tom Dart, the Cook County Sheriff, is who I was referring to. Cook County Judge Tim Evans. Well, first of all, with respect to Tim Evans, as we know, according to him, no one under 25 should be charged with a crime. Charged, much less monitored, as they don't have the intellectual development required to understand the gravity of their illegal acts. Essentially what he argued. The brain isn't fully formed until 25, therefore what exactly? Bizarre. This is why people don't pay attention or are just generally walking around in a state of incredulity. They can't believe the stuff that is true is actually true. Well, the reason I bring up Olga Maria Calderon's case is because of another case. A suit filed by the family of Keith Cooper. Keith Cooper, another high-profile case. A 73-year-old Vietnam veteran was murdered during a carjacking committed by two men on Chicago's South Side. That was in July of 2021. His daughter filed a wrongful death action against Tom Dart and Tim Evans, holding them responsible. And you'll love their pleadings in court. Evans asserting because he acted in his capacity as a judge is absolutely immune from any lawsuits for any actions he takes as a judge, including administering an electronic home monitoring system that allegedly allowed people in the program to venture out into the community and commit crimes. It's not allegedly. It's not allegedly. What's the number we're at according to CWB Chicago's running tally? 45 people so far this year who have attempted to kill or kill someone else while awaiting trial for attempting to kill or killing a person previously. So it's not allegedly. It's happening. Dart argued in his response, even if the men involved in the murder of that Vietnam veteran during the carjacking were overseen by the sheriff's office owed no special duty to prevent Keith Cooper's death. Plaintiff fails to allege the defendants were uniquely aware of the danger presented by these two who killed Keith Cooper. The defendants were uniquely aware of the danger presented to the decedent, specifically should they successfully escape from electronic monitoring. That's what Dart's attorneys wrote in a motion. In fact, the plaintiff pleads no facts indicating the defendants were aware of Mr. Cooper at all, nor do they allege any existence of any relationship between the two assailants and the victim, which could theoretically create a particular risk to the victim were the assailants to escape home confinement while on electronic monitoring. Chief Judge Evans similarly argued he owed no duty to Keith Cooper or any other specific people in the community to protect them from the criminal acts of others beyond the duty he owes as a judge to the public in general. I think some people may find this interesting because they always say, why can't you sue these elected officials for the abrogation of their duty to uphold the law and to put people who are a threat to public safety in places where they cannot be that threat. Well, there's these sovereign immunity issues. So on the law, they may be right. But isn't it just such an interesting position to take? The duties they do not owe to their constituents. You know, the people who pay their salaries. In Tom Dart's case, the people who elected them. But that even if people voted against him, obviously he owes them a duty as well. We're not uniquely aware of the danger they presented should they successfully escape electronic monitoring. Not uniquely aware. Really? I wonder, it would be interesting to litigate this actually because of this tally that we have with CWB Chicago's reporting. Last year it was some 75 individuals. This year, as I mentioned, 45 individuals who've escaped electronic monitoring or didn't escape, but while on electronic monitoring, they attempted to kill or kill somebody else in addition to, you know, while awaiting trial on felony charges of doing the same. So that sort of suggests that there's a fundamental problem with the program and the approach and their willful blindness as to the threat to public safety that electronic monitoring presents, at least as it is currently administered. Perhaps that would make the county and perhaps these individuals specifically liable, at least civilly, if not criminally. I just bring this case up because I want to get back, you know, past the legalese to give you an indication of how they view you and your personal security interests. How cavalier they are with your life. With Keith Cooper's life. With Olga Maria Calderon's life. With the lives of so many. And they're happy to be similarly cavalier with your life as well. They are ideologues or in service to ideologues who are professional antagonists to police, to prosecutors, to the law-abiding. John in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, two quick points. I wonder how this Evans would feel if a 24-year-old raped or murdered one of his family members. Would he just be so cavalier and say, oh, their brain's not fully developed, we need to let this guy go? And also, with the whole monitoring system, if somebody, say, took theirs off and committed a crime, why doesn't somebody bring a civil suit against the home monitoring device maker themselves? Why should that device be made to the point that it could be taken off? That's where the lawsuit should happen, Dan.
Well, I suppose, manufacturing defect, I don't know. I mean, again, much of this crime is being committed while they have the device on, but, you know, they're not under 24/7 surveillance, technically, or to the extent that you can track them, then you still have to beat them to wherever they are and whatever they're doing. They don't have people shadowing them, don't have those kind of resources. And even if we did, the political will to do that? No. And if you're going to do that, then why not just hold them over for trial? Which is probably the more sensible approach. Yeah. Let me give you an example, though, of who we're talking about. This is out of New York City. New York City Gangs Coalition. It's not what you think. It's not a coalition of gangs. It's essentially a coalition for gangs. Right. Hard to believe. They had a press conference the other day calling for the abolition of the gang database the New York PD uses. Take a listen.
When black and brown men gather and form alliances for camaraderie and like-minded pursuits, they're considered gang members and they're arbitrarily told that they're threats to community. quite simple, when white men do it, they're considered militias and executing their constitutional rights. So just that racial dynamic unto itself makes any gang database punitive to our communities at large, and they should not exist. You know, and finally, the only real way that, you know, we can make inroads to any issues that relate to our communities is when the police work with us, those of us who have a vested interest in being community leaders and working on these systemic issues in our neighborhoods. This is the only time we can make any inroads into any gang violence or any gang activity. A database serves no purpose and is just arbitrarily punitive to large communities at whole. Thank you.
Tiffany Caban, who is a New York City councilwoman, she called the gang database a dragnet for surveilling black and brown New Yorkers. She's also the councilwoman who said that getting mugged or worse on the New York City subway is a one in a million type event, so we shouldn't be overstating it, which drew some response from the many victims who've been mugged or worse in the New York City subway. Gang database serves no purpose. As you would imagine, police have a different take on this. And by the way, this is not just in big cities. These are in smaller communities that have gang activity. It really is so nonsensical because we start from the premise, we understand, that it's a small number of people responsible for a preponderance, if not a majority, of the violent crime. And so let's focus on it. And in Chicago, for example, or New York, it's mainly gang related. So let's focus on those people who are responsible for the majority of the violence. And now we have these violence interrupters or self-styled violence interrupters saying, no, don't. So don't cast a wide net. No. Don't cast any net. What kind of law enforcement agency, or what kind of person would suggest that a law enforcement agency should not operate with any intelligence or institutional knowledge whatsoever? So, you know, one police officer on the gang tactical units gets the information that was compiled by previous officers. You know, I mean, this is fairly straightforward stuff. I don't think I need to explain it in great detail. The idea that you should not have a database on repeat offenders, known gang members of known gangs, so that police have operational knowledge of what's happening and in whose hands on the street, and they can focus their attention where it should be on people who are involved in black market activities that have a high propensity for violence, and then mainly, and then in addition to that, in addition to the shootouts and skirmishes that occur between gangs and the victims that creates, then all the victims caught in the crossfire who are otherwise law abiding in neighborhoods that are infested by these gangs. But that's not what the thug huggers say. No dragnet whatsoever. No dragnet, no intel, no prisons, no police. We're just this close to utopia. If we could just eliminate these scourges, you know, police, prosecutors, prisons, gang databases. Mark and Rochelle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I just wanted to predict the solutions that they'll probably put forth for these, and it's always to move the goalposts. It's never to actually go to the source of the problem, whether it's prison populations, arrests, or test scores in our schools. They'll just come up and redefine what a real crime is, that a brain isn't developed, or what a reading level is. And that's how they're going to fix this. That's their non-solution.
Thanks for the call, Mark. In a related story, New York City's financial district now blighted with spiking crime and vagrants, reports the New York Post. The data for the first precinct, which includes the financial district, major crimes have increased by 50% this year. Burglaries up 70%, robbery 15%, felony assault 16%, rape 55% year over year in the financial district, you know, where the money's at. Willie Sutton.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy under the weather today. Hopefully she'll be back tomorrow or after she's over her bug. And this is Campus Beat. The question, what to do with a professor whose tests are too tough for the students? Well, New York University has an answer. Maitland Jones was a professor of chemistry at Princeton. In 2007, he semi-retired and began teaching organic chemistry at NYU on an adjunct basis. By the way, Maitland Jones, he is, I guess, described as a giant in the field of organic chemistry. He published 225 papers in his 40-year career. He wrote the textbook Organic Chemistry, which is 1,300 pages long. Not that length has necessarily anything to do with quality, but I think it's fair to say he knows a bit about organic chemistry. Teaching for 40 years at Princeton, adjunct faculty at NYU. Okay. A little credentializing there. He was the subject of a petition that was circulated by some of his students, signed by 82 of his 350 students, that alleged that many of them were failing and this was unacceptable. According to the petition, here's what they experienced. This is quoting their petition. We urge you to realize that a class with such a high percentage of withdrawals and low grades has failed to make students' learning and well-being a priority. Well-being. And reflects poorly on the chemistry department as well as the institution as a whole. They complained about the emotional and mental health toll that Maitland Jones's organic chemistry class was having on these aspiring doctors. Maitland Jones said they weren't coming to class, that's for sure. They weren't watching the videos and they weren't able to answer the questions. In response to this and through the pandemic, Jones, the professor, made a number of accommodations for the struggling students. He reduced the difficulty of his exams, but it didn't improve performance much. Students were misreading exam questions at an astonishing rate, said Professor Jones. So what do you do about this situation? Well, you fire him, which is what they did. You gotta get rid of this guy. Jones learned to teach during a time when the goal was to teach at a very high and rigorous level, said Paramjit Arora, a professor of chemistry at NYU, former colleague of Jones, told the New York Times this. We hope the students will see that putting them through that rigor is doing them good. Well, 82 of them don't see that. 82 out of 350. Spokesperson for NYU said, troubling indicators, high rate of student withdrawal, student petition signed by those 82 students I mentioned, course evaluation scores were by far the worst, not only among members of the chemistry department, but by all among all university undergraduate science courses. Maybe a bit of an old school guy, maybe. Does that have something to do with it? Celebrated organic chemistry professor Maitland Jones had high standards, and we can't have that in 2022, writes Freddie DeBoer, who is a leftist author. NY students, who are by any rational measure some of the most privileged people on planet Earth, organized a petition and got him fired. I hope you never get treated by one of the doctors who emerges from this mess, Certainly not anyone who signed that petition. Seriously, if I had a doctor I knew graduated or spent any time at NYU, I would ask him, hey, you by chance weren't one of the 82 who signed that petition that got Maitland Jones fired, were you? Maybe I'd be willing to take a chance on the others, although NYU as an institution is obviously doing for their institution what those 82 students did to Maitland Jones, which is to defile it. But I'd like to know the petition signers before I take advice and counsel or more from any doctor who was one, assuming they become one. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. Over 50 years ago, going to engineering school, I won't get into particulars, names, whatever, but I had a similar experience with a different outcome. I was taking a cutting-edge engineering class in structural design, and it was really an intense course. And a couple of weeks into the course, the students put together a petition because of the intensity of the lectures by the professor. The administration came back and said, I'm sorry, gentlemen, but this is the way the course is going to be taught. Any of you that don't want to take the course, you're allowed to cancel, and we'll give you your money back. Probably at least half the class dropped out. Went through the course and completed it and got a fairly good grade. The next semester, the professor was up to teach another cutting-edge course in design. I registered for the course because I wanted this course. And there was only one other individual that signed up for the course, and the course was never offered.
A long, steady slide. Thanks for the call, Bob. The quality of post-K through 12 education. We were talking about Illinois schools last hour. Now we're talking about the elite schools at the next level, all those schools that confer such status to their graduates. Should they? Future doctors, med schools. You know, Stanley Goldfarb, who I believe is Columbia, Dr. Stanley Goldfarb, he's been writing about what's happening in med schools for the last several years, series of op-eds in Wall Street Journal that have been very good. So there are people trying to alert attention to these problems, like at NYU. Tom and Mokina, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. I find this, what you're talking about, amazing. I got a degree in biology back in the 90s, and organic chemistry at U of I Urbana is exactly what this Maitland guy was doing. It was tough. People dropped the course. I personally took the course three times because it was at 8 a.m., and I remember on the first test, the highest grade in the class was like a 28 or a 17, and the teacher said, so this becomes the A, and it slides down. So, I mean, you know, I think I got like a 9 on that test, and it was still a C. Mm-hmm. It was just a tough course. And that's how they deal with people's inability to understand the subject. You find out who is this proverbial whiz kid that just breathes organic chemistry. And the rest of us, you know, I mean, you're going to consult the textbook when you're treating me later on in life anyway, and what a ketone or an alkane does, right? But, I mean, the whole point is to push forward, and it's just sad to hear. I don't know much about New York University, but I mean, it's a tragedy that anything like this has happened at any higher institution. Yeah. And I'm sure most of the people out there listening feel the same way, at least to you and Amy. So
thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. I hope that's the case. I hope that's the case. And I hope that means that you're paying as much attention when it comes, and your kids are, to choice of an institution of allegedly higher learning as you do to what happens at the K through 12 level when they're, you know, closer to your purview as a parent. I hope share these stories to talk to them about what the point here is. And per Tom and Mokina's point, this is what many doctors are saying. Alice Dreger, who's a bioethicist, former professor of medical humanities, this article, she's talking about the New York Times report on Jones's firing. The article made my skin crawl. We aren't going to end up with good doctors by letting undergrad pre-meds pass organic chem because universities want to protect their U.S. news rankings. Here again, you think the point is to turn out good doctors, and maybe the point of the adults in charge of the system is to protect and enhance their perch. Other doctors have weighed in on this and essentially say, yeah, what Tom and Mokinda said, organic chemistry is the bane of medical students everywhere because it is so difficult. But that's the point. The class is designed to act as a gatekeeper, preventing underqualified students from entering the field of medicine. That's the point. Nope. You know what the point is? Well, you heard it from the 82 petition signers. The point is to protect my well-being, because this is giving me emotional trouble, my struggles with organic chem. Okay. Roger, Southside.
Yeah, I think maybe a couple of arrogant listeners missed out on the fact that, okay, here's the problem with most people under 35 now. Okay, you go, you endure, and you're going to possibly fail. And you learn from that, from your failures, that eventually you're going to get over it. I mean, the standards that are set right now, I mean, we are a third world country. I mean, everybody, most people look at any media, look how China, when these kids come in the morning in China, they scrub their own bathrooms, they scrub their own schools. After lunch, they prepare their own lunches. How do you think they stack up against CPS here? You know, a bunch of Section 8 moms teaching them and school boarding them. And, you know, well, this isn't fair and that's not fair. It's a joke. They're in a rude awakening.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Well, yeah, so when you deal with the emotional trauma that organic chem dealt you and you wind up perhaps not going into medicine, you just go into the general workforce. You take the same approach, I suppose. But then so do many of your superiors. Interesting future view responses. Future view is this column I refer to semi-frequently, where the Wall Street Journal editorial board gets opinions from current college students or postgraduate students on a salient topic of the day. So this week it was quiet quitting. Have you heard about this phenomenon, quiet quitting? It's sort of Office Space 2.0. You know, I'm not quitting. I'm just not showing up anymore. This is sort of the same thing. And even if I'm showing up, I'm just not doing anything anymore. But I'm not quitting. I still expect to be paid. Or I'm indifferent about it. Why work? George Bednar, University of Notre Dame. In the past, people were lauded for hard work. The modern world praises comfort and balance instead. Think of remote work. Few white-collar workers go into the office anymore. They'd rather lounge in Lululemon sweatpants in their Google Nest homes. Instead of wearing suits with comb-back hair, billionaires such as Mark Zuckerberg sport plain white T-shirts with tousled locks. In the 21st century dress code of corporate America leaders reflects the approach to work. It isn't high stakes. This trickles down on their Gen Z subordinates who look for excuses to work less, Zoom instead of travel, and demand ridiculous HR benefits. If you don't have to work hard, why would you? The farmer working to put food on the table is a distant memory, as ASEA bowls and Netflix and TikTok dominate the mind. A recent interaction demonstrated this new apathy for hard work. My mom told her friend from a local tennis club that her son hoped to join the military. The woman responded, "Why would you let him do that? He has so many safer options." This is the sentiment about hard work in our country. Someone else will do it. The quiet quitting. And now the other side of the conversation. Adam Barsuk at Jefferson University, who is pre-med right on topic. Listen to his take on quiet quitting. For decades, minimum wage laws and median salaries, particularly in the service sector, haven't kept up with inflation. Rising wages, COVID, only part of the inflation picture. For decades, America has struggled with corporate bloat. From sectors as disparate as fast food and healthcare, many workers lack independence and feel exploited. Instead of no longer do average workers own a part of their small business or pursue private practice. Instead, they feel like cogs in a machine watching salaries stagnate as corporate profits grow to record highs. If American companies want to reinvigorate their employees, they could take the approach of the founder of Panasonic, who approaches company like family, give employees the independence to explore their interests and innovate on the job while rewarding them when the company prospered. Instead of pointing fingers at Gen Z's work ethic, corporate America ought to reevaluate its own management practices. Mm-hmm. Yep. The quiet quitters. The fact that we're talking about quiet quitters, I think, speaks to the cultural problem. Tom in Blue Island.
Well, hey, Dan, it seems like for the last hour and a half, you laid out a pretty strong argument about who education's for, the teachers, their union, and their sinecures, and absolutely not about children, sir.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
You tried your best, and you failed miserably. The lesson is, never try.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy under the weather. She's out this morning. Hopefully back soon. My People Who Play by the Rules pack posted a new ad on the airwaves yesterday. Managed to get this through the minders at the network affiliates, at least so far. And, you know, until Pritzker complains. And then I'm sure we'll have to fight about that, like I've had to fight about just about every spot there. They try to, you know, pretend to fulfill the requirements of their license when it comes to political speech and they do so as nearly as possible to, protect the shield. What's the shield? The Democrat Party. The Pritzker. Yeah. Well, here's a spot that I'm sure will surprise, did surprise many once it got around yesterday. Take a listen. And go online for a look-see or, you know, if you watch network affiliate television, you'll see it.
For 25 years, ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas gave you the straight news. Now, he's giving you real talk on the governor's race.
Darren Bailey, I met the man. He's a family farmer. Somebody who understands what it's like to go to work every day. Somebody who's fair-minded. I could trust this guy. I could trust this guy. Yeah, farmer from Southern Illinois. Yeah, yeah, a farmer from Southern Illinois.
I love the way he says that. He's like, yeah, what, a farmer from Southern Illinois? That's crazy. Yeah, yeah, crazy like a fox. Yeah, a farmer from Southern Illinois. Let's do something different if we want different. For more on his affiliation with the me and my nefarious pack, and his decision to get involved in a public way in this race, pleased to be joined by former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for you. You know, Dan, as Joe Biden says, if you don't vote for me, if you're black and you don't vote for me, then you ain't black. So, and I think that's what the reaction is getting with a lot of people.
You're no longer black?
I think I am. I'm looking at it now, and I am. But the thing is, that's the understated Democratic line for many, many years. The Democrats tell black people that you got to vote for Democrats or you ain't black. They've been saying that for decades. And all the while, they aren't producing anything that improves the lot of the black community. But they tell you that, and people have bought it for decades. And one of the reasons that I'm getting involved in a very personal way, and the first time I've gotten involved in a campaign in a partisan way, is to defeat that notion that somehow If you're black, you got to be a Democrat. And if you don't vote Democrat, then you're not black. That's got to end. We're going to end it this cycle.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, in terms of like, you know, don't believe your lying eyes and ears. Just believe what the party tells you. Very Orwellian, literally Orwellian in nature. This editorial from The Wall Street Journal we tackled a bit earlier in the show, and we've tackled the story any number of times, but it speaks to what you're saying. 36% in 2019, so pre-pandemic, assume the numbers are worse, 36% of third graders in Illinois can read at grade level. Only 36%, a little bit more than one in three. For black third graders, it's a little bit more than one in five, 22%. And in places with heavy black population like Rockford, 7% of black third graders in Rockford reading at grade level. 8% of black third graders in Peoria. What does that tell you about how things are going as we pour more and more money into the system and into the same hands that operate those systems?
Yeah, because, you know, if you live in the city of Chicago, and you're reading at those horrendous rates, your reading scores are that low, there is not a Republican anywhere who has anything to do with your public education system in the city of Chicago. It's all run by Democrat hacks, right? And people have got to just wake up and understand that. You can say the same thing about your criminal justice system in Chicago and Cook County, how all the wrongful convictions that have occurred over the years, the horrible record of prosecutors, some of the stuff we're seeing today, those are all your Democrats. You can't even complain about police brutality in the city of Chicago without ultimately coming up with a Democrat who's in charge of the system of rooting out police brutality and police corruption or political corruption. It's all controlled by the Democrat Party. So what I'm saying is just borne out by fact. Who's running the show? Your taxes in the South Suburbs, where black homeowners in the South Suburbs are paying property taxes at several times the rate of what people are paying in the Cook suburbs and in the northern suburbs,
yeah,
on the North Shore.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, who's setting those tax rates in Flossmoor and Olympia Fields and Matteson? The Democrat Party. Those are Democrats doing that to you. So there's got to be a change, and black voters have got to stand up to even make the Democrats do their jobs. Become more effective in their leadership. I mean, they've got to go to the middle. They've got to go to the middle and look at what they've been doing in the past and seeing that it isn't working. And you know what they say, the old cliche about insanity. We know that one.
Right.
And how's it working out for you? Just ask yourself, how's it working out for you? If you live in the South Suburbs, how's it working out for you? And I can tell you, I can answer for you. But you answer for yourself.
You know, from our conversations, I know that you don't necessarily affiliate with the Republican Party. You don't call yourself a Republican. This is more, your involvement is more of a commentary on the longstanding power structure in this state and the results, is my interpretation. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, Dan, I'll say it. I've never pulled a Republican ballot in my life. I mean, never have. Now, I didn't pull Republican ballots when I was a political reporter for obvious reasons. But even before then, before I started working entirely in the politics, I'd vote. I'm a voter. I'm engaged. But I never pulled a Republican ballot. Why pull a Republican ballot when you're living in the city of Chicago? Because there's generally nothing to vote for. You know, nobody's on the ballot. There's, you know, these guys are running unopposed in the Democrat primaries, most of them, the state reps, and if there is a token Republican candidate there, you know, the person going to win. So, you know, that's who I am as a voter and have been, and that's what most black voters are. But I gave up on it many years ago, and I've been thinking about this for decades. Why black people are not brokering their political strength by looking at the other party and look and seeing who's running. And this Pritzker Bailey race is a classic. It's a classic. Because if you notice something, they haven't come up with anything on Darren Bailey so far. No, not even a wisp of scandal or corruption or anything like that. They just come up with these generalized name calling extremist. They're calling him an extremist. What's that? An extremist because he's pro-life? I'm pro-life. I don't think of myself as an extremist because he's pro-Second Amendment. Well, hey, I got a Foyd card. I mean, what's, am I an extremist? This man made his bones on the school board in Clay County, far southeast corner of the state. He's a God-fearing, prayerful, fair-minded, family-focused farmer. He's a farmer. And the mainstream media is playing in to this whole business of him being some kind of far-right extremist. They say he's a, they call him a wealthy farmer. I mean, wealthy farmer. I saw his tax returns. WBEZ tried to do a hit piece on his taxes, and they came up with a couple of $100,000. Now, if you have a couple of $100,000 in Clay County, Illinois, hey, you're doing it. You're one of the big earners. But a couple of $100,000 in Streeterville, Gold Coast, where JB lives. Come on, you might get a you might get a garage, maybe a garage. He's not wealthy. He's a regular guy. Again, he's just a regular guy, but he's a good businessman because he runs a big. His family owns 30,000 acres, I think, in Clay County. He runs a farm. He's got to get those wheat, the corn, the soybeans. He's got to, you know, grow them, and then he's got to get them to market and all that. He knows he's a smart guy, very smart guy, and very well respected. He and his wife, Cindy, opened a Christian school. That's how they made their bones down there, and people know who they are. They're great people. And again, they're not a wisp. Remember J.B. ran? He had the toilet scandal going. He called black people offensive. Remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's JB. He's got a sheet, as they call it in Chicago. He's got a sheet. And but he won because he ran against Rauner, and Rauner was, you know, he's out to lunch. That's another story. I won't get into that.
And now he's been transformed, has JB, the trust fund kid. Who's made some intemperate remarks on FBI surveillance tapes with Blagojevich? That's what you're referencing.
Oh my God! Yeah,
he's a hero of the working man now, according to the Chicago Press Corps.
Isn't that crazy? People got to understand. You know, 99% of Illinoisans have more in common with Darren Bailey than they would ever have in common with J.B. Pritzker. You know, a line that I'm using when I'm asked, you know, they call Darren an extremist. I said the only extremist in this governor's race is J.B. Pritzker. He is extremely, extremely rich. I mean, I'm not saying that bad or good or bad, but that's extreme. He makes extreme amounts of money or has extreme amounts of money and wealth. And he's trying to convince you that he's the people's candidate. I mean, this whole thing, this whole script has been flipped in the past few years of, you know, who's on the side of working people and who is not. It's the elitist Democrats versus the rest of us.
I wanted to get your take on this topic of cannabis licenses, because I mentioned it on this show, but I don't have sort of the personal connection to it, not industry wise, but in terms of what happened that you do, and you've spoken about it a lot. You know, the issue, just to set it up, is not whether you support or oppose the legalization of marijuana, because I actually oppose it, but I appreciate the perspective that you have on what went down, because I also oppose people who make promises to get things done, to get things through, and then don't fulfill those promises. They sort of use people as means to their political ends, and that's what happened in with respect to the dispensary licenses, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, first keep in mind that the whole business of recreational marijuana, selling it, was created out of whole cloth by the politicians. And J.B. Pritzker is one of the pillars of his first term. He was going to legalize recreational cannabis sales. And he said, he promised, there would be equity in how we do it. Now, given the fact they're creating it out of whole cloth, then they've got to be very mindful of who is allowed to get the licenses. But so J.B. was able to pass the bill, which Darren Bailey voted against, by the way. But anyway, he was able to pass the bill by promising equity. There's that word that the Democrats use a lot, equity, right? Mm-hmm. So you can only assume, well, I guess there's got to be equity because, you know, they're creating this out of whole cloth. Black people got absolutely none of the first licenses that were issued. None, zero. How did that happen? Well, they created so many regulations and hoops that you had to jump through that only their cronies, white males, were able to get licenses. That has outraged many black people that I talked to. I don't know anybody who thinks that was fair because, again, the licenses were given away, but they went to Democrat cronies. And they happened to be white males for the most part. Well, all part. I mean, there were no black males involved in this. And people are outraged. They are outraged because it denied a group of black people, probably should be 15 to 20% somewhere in there, that were denied generational wealth. I mean, this is a multi-billion-dollar business now in Illinois, and black people are not sharing in it. Now, Johnny come lately, now that the campaign is on, he said, well, we're going to give these so-called social justice licenses or something like, I don't know what they're calling it. But let's deal with it. The first licenses are the most lucrative, the ones that went downtown in the loop to North Shore, Skokie, Northbrook, places like that. Black people had no chance to get any of those licenses. So what he's doing, he'll let you open a cannabis store in Auburn Gresham or Roseland,
yeah,
or West Englewood. I mean, they're resegregating the cannabis industry. The Democrats who talk this fast game about equity, they don't give it to you. If you need a measuring stick about the Democrats, if they say they're going to do it, they're going to do just the opposite. That's what they do. That's how they roll, as they say. They will promise whatever they talk about equity. They're not going to give you equity. I mean, I believe what you do, you provide opportunity, and equity happens organically. It's got to happen organically, or it's not equity, not true equity. You've got to provide opportunity, and they denied opportunity by creating these awful regulations around the issuance of licenses that would eliminate the vast, vast majority of anybody that they wanted to eliminate, and they did. And people are outraged by this. This is a wedge issue this year in the black community, and all we have to do is remind people of what happened, because they can see the cannabis stores, and they know how much money they're making, and you're not getting it. You're not part of it, and JB's going to have to pay for that. He's going to have to be punished for that.
Well, I mean,
just plain and simple.
Yeah, I mean, it's a party for which rich white elites who use other people who are not rich white elites as mascots to cover what they're doing.
Bingo.
Right?
Bingo. They use this for mascots. They have black people out walking in front of, black people who remain with the Democratic Party have to get involved in all these other issues that have nothing to do with us, that we intrinsically do not support this, the whole transgender piece, the whole, you name it. Drag queen reading stuff. You look on television, you see people marching outside of Kavanaugh's House in Washington a few months ago, and it's a black woman beating a drum, walking around, you know, outraged about Kavanaugh. I mean, come on. That isn't our. We got bigger fish to fry right now. We got other stuff to worry about. But we're being used. We're being used to be the point people because of our historic suffering. Because you can't be denied that, you know, we've had some tough road to hoe at times in this country. So they use us as mascots. It's a great word, mascots, for all these other causes that we really don't have anything to do with. I mean. They have us out promoting open borders. I've seen many black congressmen promoting open borders. I'm like, what? Open borders, and your people have the highest unemployment rate in the country as a racial breakdown group, and you're out here supporting, you know, millions of people coming across the border unaccounted for, getting all kinds of freebies. I mean, black people don't support this stuff that we're being forced to walk point on.
Now we just got to get people to not support the people that are doing that stuff and, you know, connect those dots.
This is an election where this is it. This is it. This is Gettysburg. This is it, man. We got to do it here.
All right. Motivated Charles Thomas, former ABC 7 political reporter, now a consultant to People Who Play by the Rules pack, my pack. Charles, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, and thank you for providing the opportunity to get this message to people, because others have not done that. When they've had a chance to do it in the past, they haven't done it. But now we're down to cases. We got to get it done.
All right. You got it, my friend. Charles Thomas joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy's not here this morning. She's under the weather, but hopefully she'll be feeling better and be back tomorrow. We'll see. This is an interesting development. Joliet is not a conservative stronghold. That's just in. But it's a blue-collar community, a lot of sensible people. They don't elect sensible people to legislative office. They don't support sensible people for statewide office, generally speaking. At least it's been a while, certainly since Jake and Elwood got out of prison. But this resolution from the city council up for review, and because most of the Joliet City Council is up for re-election in April next year. Oh, yeah. You think the fallout from the purge law, the so-called Safety Act, is going to end on November 8th? No, it's not. All those municipal officials who were quiet or worse, a lot of them are up for re-election next year, election or re-election. The resolution reads like this. The city of Joliet encourages legislators to work with public safety representatives and all community stakeholders to fix remaining problems. What? Remaining problems. I heard from the governor, it's just some wordplay issues. We got to spitball some of the lingo. That's it. But on the substance, no problems. Encourages legislators to work with public safety representatives and all community stakeholders to fix remaining problems with the Safety Act, including but not limited to unreasonably limiting the imposition of cash bail, unreasonably limiting police officer discretion to make arrests, imposing unreasonable police certification and decertification standards, and mandating unreasonable custodial accommodations. That's a lot of unreasonables. That's a lot of unreasonables in that resolution, isn't it? Huh. What about the unreasonable Democrats who represent the city of Joliet at the local, state, federal level? It's something we said earlier in the show. Actually, we were just talking to Charles Thomas about it. Connecting the dots between unreasonable policies and the unreasonable policymakers. Those policies don't make themselves, folks. Speaking of Charles Thomas, who has come out to speak his mind on topics particularly related to black families in Chicagoland and Illinois, but more broadly, as you heard from him, now that he's retired, he doesn't have to play along with the established power structure. Another gentleman doing the same thing, Bob Fioretti. He was a two-term Chicago alderman, Democrat. Now he's the Republican nominee for Cook County Board President against Tony. Bob, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Great to be here this morning.
By the way, the website for more information, fearreadyforcook.com, fearreadyforcook.com. You know, Tony Preckwinkle is the mentor of Kim Fox. She is an institutionalist in Cook County and the city of Chicago. She was an alderman for a while, too. And so she has a lot to do with the lawlessness in Chicago, too, even though she hasn't gotten perhaps the profile on the issue that she deserves. Isn't that right?
Well, one of the business folks in the city of Chicago approached me, and she said, and he said that she has kept her fingerprints off of much of what's happening here. But she is the chief architect of these failed policies that have led to, as you were saying, the crime surge here in the city of Chicago and in the county. It's her hand-picked protege, state's attorney, who has repeatedly failed the residents here of this county. And they have provided ineffective public safety. They've enacted harmful, dangerous policies. She is a leader of the movement to defund the police and, in fact, passing resolutions as such. She continues, as I look at it, and I've known her for a while, to minimize law enforcement, treating violent offenders as victims, and disregarding the well-being of a law-abiding Cook County residents.
Well, and something else, too. I recall when she ran for Cook County Board President, first ran for Cook County Board President, part of her platform, so she was ahead of the curve here with the defund and decarcerate and don't prosecute. She one of her platform planks was to reduce the population of the Cook County Jail. Now, if you want to reduce it, I want to do reforms to make sure nonviolent offenders get alternative sentencing. Well, that's one thing, but that's not what she said. She said,
"Well,
she said
exactly what she said was to reduce jail population.
Reduce regardless of. I mean, I just want to get the numbers down. I don't care who is being let out. I just want the numbers to get down."
And that was exactly what's happening. You can see what's happening now in the streets of the city. We see this crime is on the rise, contrary to what the mayor and all these other so-called experts are saying. The problem that, you know, maybe Chicago is not a hellhole, but it sure is a war zone. 500 murders so far this year. 2,800 people shot in the city of Chicago. And where is the outcry from the so-called political leaders? When I was in the city council, I called upon the aldermen on two different occasions to stand up and rise up and start battling this crime issue. Defunding the police has been a movement that has been accelerated through the last few years. And Tony Preckwinkle was one of these leaders who wanted to defund the police, cut the jail population. The Safety Act was something she was talking about way before the Safety Act ever came in the dead of night and passage here. People have to understand the importance of what this election is. This could be the most important election in the state of Illinois because she is the head of the Democratic Party. And let's think about this. She controls Fox's budget, the judicial arm budget, and the sheriff's budget, and 9 other elected official budgets. If you wanted to become slated by the Democratic Party for a judge, you had to do two things. One, give $40,000 to the Democratic Party, which is Tony Preckwinkle. And two, sign an oath of loyalty to the Democratic Party. Not to the Constitution, but to the Democratic Party. So you were beholden to Tony Preckwinkle. This is an important election. People must come out and vote for me and for many of the other Republicans that are on throughout the county of Cook.
So is it elected officials like Preckwinkle and Lightfoot and even Rahm before her that pushed you out of the Democrat Party, you know, to run as a Republican this time?
Well, you know, even in my first time running in 06, 07, I was accused of being a Republican. I supported good Republican candidates my whole life, both financially and physically, getting out there and knocking on doors for them. The Democratic Party left me, and I said it publicly 6 years ago, that it left me, and it has left so many other people, working-class people like me, growing up on the south side of Chicago, and seeing what has happened with this far left agenda of this Democratic Party.
Yeah, it seems to me, I mean, accused of being a Republican, that is an accusation in the city. It seems to me that it's time to flip that stigma, and people should be afraid to be accused of being a Democrat with what the Democrats have done to the city and the county.
And you see it up and down. It's tax and spend. They've run out of ideas. Why are so many people leaving the city council? Because they've run out of ideas other than taxing and spending. And that's the problem. My core principles have not changed one iota, and I'm still the same person. I was viewed also as an anti-corruption candidate. I stood for the working class people. I stood for law enforcement. Six times out of the eight budgets, I made mention that we were cutting back the police, which was wrong. We need to help and support our officers and people that are in law enforcement and first responders. And here we are. That is why this is one of the most important elections, not only in the state but in the nation, because we must stop this aggressive leftist agenda that is occupying our cities, counties, and the state of Illinois.
One of the things that she just launched, Tony, is this universal basic income pilot program, $42 million to give people $500 to $3,200 a month just for existing. But she's promised to make it, and this is eligible, people eligible up to about $58,000 in household income. She's promised to scale that countywide, which would make it, in terms of that eligibility threshold, make it a program that would cost something on the order of $3.5 to $4 billion if everybody who was eligible under those guidelines actually applied for that monthly payment. And meanwhile, the west and south sides of Chicago and so much of south suburban Cook County are demilitarized zones. What can the county do? What would it do under you with respect to those blighted areas of the city and the county, short of these giveaways just for existing that Preckwinkle and Lightfoot are initiating? Where do you come down on those, and what would you do more globally?
Well, I did create and brought into my ward 8,000 jobs when I was an alderman. I believe in economic development, economic growth. But what we also did at the time was make sure that we hired locally. Don't forget, I was my ward was 76% African American, and I made sure that people were hired from our communities. I would come home and see on the front steps or in my area drug dealers asking, "I can't keep selling drugs. I have a couple kids. I have 3 or 4 kids. Can you help me get a job?" I still, to this years later, run into some of the people that we got jobs for. I think economic growth, making sure we hire, train people from the community to get jobs, because as I've said for the last, since 06, 07, the best way to stop crime is to make sure that people have jobs. And there are good economic opportunity zones to have investments, have growth, but you just can't throw money at individuals. They have to have a stake in the community. I think this guaranteed income program that has been proposed only serves 3,200 people plus. What we really need is finding ways to have them job training and have them invest in the community. Don't forget, Cook County is 15% at or below the poverty level. That's a drop in the bucket on what she's planning on doing. And we need to have people have good educational opportunities, get the trades back, and start employing people.
And reduce the amount of money that people need to throw at county government. So We were talking about this with Charles Thomas last hour, and that's a fact. I mean, the highest property tax rates as a percentage of home value in Cook County are in places like Ford Heights, and not places like Wilmette. And that's just insane, but that's what the property tax system produces. Fritz Kagi promised to address it. I don't know how well that's going. There's no evidence it's going very well. What about that, using your bully pulpit as Cook County Board Chairman to talk about redoing how Cook County classifies property, provide some relief, particularly to those on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder?
Well, I work with a lot of the southern suburbs, and I'm seeing what's happening there. And as you just said, the ratio is just out of whack. If you buy a home in the south suburbs, you can't afford the taxes. The taxes sometimes, after a few year period, are higher than what you paid for the home. We need to work that out. Don't forget, one other landmark that she said 4 years ago, not only was she going to lower the jail population, but she was going to get the property tax bills out on time.
Yeah,
we're
right.
We're still waiting for them.
Oh, pushing them. Yeah, that's the other thing, pushing them past the election. I talked to Tom DeVore about this, Republican nominee for Attorney General, and there should be a lot more attention to this. I mean, it's so obvious what they're doing, pushing these property tax bills past November 8th.
And you know what's going to happen? It's going to be the whammy when you see the increase in your property taxes then. People are struggling right now, and you're not going to get your tax bill until December. You have to pay it by the end of December to get any federal tax breaks you want. The whole thing between Kagi and Preckwinkle has just been a sham of avoiding the issues that are facing this county and to get all of them to get reelected here at this time.
So in 2020, Judge O'Brien, who ran against Kim Fox, also a Democrat whose party left him, like you were describing yourself. I mean, he walloped Kim Fox in suburban Cook County outside of Thornton Township. But I mean, generally, he won suburban Cook County, even with Thornton Township, even with Evanston, even with Oak Park. But he got crushed in the city. And so, you know, I suspect you'll do very well in suburban Cook County, maybe better in some of those communist areas than even O'Brien did. But the city, you can't get beat in the city the way that O'Brien got beat by Fox and win the election. How do you do it?
Well, you know, when I ran against her 4 years ago in the primary, I got almost 40%. I hope to retain a lot of that. Get the Republicans who are out there and get them motivated to vote, and the independents. Now, I've been going, I'll say, door to door. I was in Little Village in the heart of Chewy Country, the congressman, and people came up to me and said, are you a Democrat? I said, no, I am a Republican. Then they would say, good, I'm voting for you. The Hispanic movement now is really those that want jobs, good education, and to give back to their communities, and they don't see it with their current leadership. And I think we're going to see a lot of change even here in the city of Chicago. Some of the hard areas, they're not going to change, but the Democratic Party is going to do whatever they can to make sure that they ensure power and keep power, and that includes whatever they have to do in the polling places to make sure that they're ensuring that they have the ballots, they have the votes.
He is Bob Fioretti, two-term Chicago alderman, now a Democrat, now a Republican candidate for Cook County, Republican nominee for Cook County Board President, running against Tony Preckwinkle. More information, support his candidacy, get involved. Fioretti, Fioretti, Fioretti for Cook.com. Bob Fioretti, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great morning. And to all your listeners, make sure they get out and vote on November 8th, and I know they will. Thank you very much, and spread the word.
And Bob Fioretti joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy under the weather today, so she's off. Hopefully she'll be well and back soon. Yesterday, Peter Ducey, maybe along with Phil Wegman, the only reporters in the D.C. press corps actually interested in providing some inquiries that push back against the accepted narrative emanating from the White House as dutifully read by Karine Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat. Best she can, at least, which ain't great. So Ducey has a simple question for KJP yesterday as we've watched the explanation for gas prices change over the last several months, depending on where gas prices were and in which direction they were going. Here's how that went.
Thanks, Karine. You've said the president was responsible for gas prices coming down. Is the president responsible for gas prices going up?
So it's a lot more nuanced than that, right? Peter, you know this. There have been global challenges that we have all have dealt with. When I say all, meaning other countries as well, have dealt with since the pandemic. There's been pandemic and there's been Putin's war. And Putin's war has increased gas prices at the pump. We have seen that over the past several months. And what the president was able to do, he took some historic steps when you think about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and making sure that we were able to do everything that we can to bring that cost down for American families, give them a little bit more of a breathing room. And we saw that. We saw that every day this summer, saving American families over $1 per gallon. And so that is what the president's going to continue to stay focused on, our American consumers. How do we continue to keep prices down? That's why we did the Inflation Reduction Act. That's why we talk about the CHIPS Act. All of these things are going to help Americans here.
The CHIPS Act? With semiconductors? The industrial policy and the semiconductor situation? I'm sorry, what does that have to do with? Well, what does anything have to do with anything that KJP has to say, prattling on as she does? So just so you understand, here's the top line, if I can cut through all of that bilge that you just had to experience. When gas prices are reduced, it is 100% Biden's work product. And when gas prices go up, it's a nuanced issue. And you know what a lot of it has to do with, too. She didn't get to it, so I will on her behalf. Corporate greed. Yep, corporate greed is rearing its ugly head. Big oil, big gas, just like big beef and big turkey and big grocery. Same thing. For example, Jennifer Granholm, the intergalactic energy person for the administration, on oil companies, these companies need to focus less on taking every last dollar off the table and more on passing through savings to their customers. Exactly. Big, bad corporations. Yeah, that's right. One asked to wonder, as James Freeman wonders aloud in his Best of the Web column on the topic, what makes big corporations run by men and women of the left, what makes them so greedy when Biden is in office as compared to when a Trump is in office, for example? Why do they get their greed on when it's a Democrat in the White House? It's curious how that ebbs and flows according to the political affiliation of the president. Huh. Maybe Steve Moore can help us. Steve Moore, columnist, economist, author of Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, good to be with you. And the answer to your question is everything has to do with everything. I mean, these results
profound
that we're seeing, are entirely the predictable result of a Biden administration war on fossil fuels. And if you declare on fossil fuel development and production, guess what, folks? You're going to have a higher energy crisis. I mean, this isn't that complicated. And so we have a new study. This is a nice setup for something I wanted to tell you this morning. It literally just released it yesterday by myself and Casey Mulligan at the University of Chicago, one of the top economists in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we estimate in our study that the United States today, if we had just stuck with the Trump energy policies, if we just, stayed all in for producing all the energy we have, the United States would be producing about 3 million more barrels a day of oil. Now, what would that mean? Well, that would mean for our economy, about $100 billion more output. It would mean we wouldn't have to go have our president go prostrate to the Saudi oil sheiks and beg them to increase their oil production. By the way, you've seen, Dan, I'm sure that they're reducing their oil production. They're not increasing it to keep the price as high as possible.
Good. Another party for them to blame. It's OPEC. It's Putin's fault. It's OPEC's fault. It's just not
course,
our fault.
Of course, it's OPEC.
Right. Yeah.
Now, here's the other part of this, and then is that I think in that clip that you played from, what's her name again? I keep forgetting.
Karine Jean-Pierre.
Yes, Karine Jean-Pierre. She was saying, oh, we even used the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to keep prices low. Well, guess what? We are now the lowest level of our Strategic Petroleum Reserve since the summer of 1984 when Reagan was starting to build up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And so we're getting close to running on empty on that. The cupboard is getting bare on that one. And so we estimate if we had just kept producing oil and gas as we had under Trump, we would have produced five times more oil and gas than the amount we've depleted from the petroleum. So we wouldn't have had to extract one drop of oil from the reserve if we had just kept producing. And so this is an idiotic, moronic, crazy, lunatic energy policy that is causing not just higher gas prices, but look at what's happening to utility costs. One other quick thing. You know, the other day, Gavin Newsom said, we in California are a model for the nation's energy policy. Did you know that the Californians are paying $6 a gallon for gas today, and their utility bills are twice as expensive as the rest of the state? And that's the model for the country. This guy's going to run for president.
Well, here's some good news on all this, you know, with their trotting out their usual misdirection plays and rationalizations and general misinformation. The good news is, and this, by the way, coming from a CNN analyst, looking at Gallup's polling on the midterms, and the question that Gallup asks, you know, what your most important issue is, and then the follow-up question, which is a key one, on your most important issue, who do you have more confidence in to properly address it, Republicans or Democrats? And on that, who do you have the most confidence in to address the problems, the issues most important to you? Republicans have an 11-point lead, which is the greatest spread for Republicans since the midterm elections in 1946. So that portends pretty well in the closing weeks if that spread persists.
Well, a couple things. I mean, first of all, what are the issues they care about? Number one, is inflation. Well, obviously, Democrats haven't done a very good job at inflation. We've got the highest inflation rate in 40 years. The second one is just overall state of the economy. It's pretty miserable right now. So that obviously isn't something Biden's done a good job on. The third one would be gas prices, which you just mentioned, which had been coming down. I'll give Biden credit. You know, the gas price had come down, but it's doing a U-turn now that the prices are going back up again. And then the other two that are huge are crime. I know that's a big one in Chicago. Just the general sense of and education, which for the first time, Republicans are about even with Democrats.
Yeah.
Education used to be an issue that Democrats dominated, but people saw what happened with the schools. And I have to say, I get so frustrated with my friends in Illinois. I'm going to just say something to your voters in Illinois. I don't care whether you like Darren Bailey or not. I don't think this election in Illinois is about Darren Bailey. It is about elections are about the incumbent. Do you think that Putzker has been a good governor? And you know what? If the people in Illinois said, yeah, thumbs up, keep doing it, Putzker, you're doing a great job, then you deserve it. You deserve the crap that you get out of Springfield and out of Chicago if you reelect these people. I mean, how it's just mystifying to me, Dan, how anybody could vote for Putzker. And I'm not saying this is a Republican, Democrat. The guy has been a failure in everything that he has done. Tell me one thing that he's done right, Dan.
I'm going to have to get back to you on that. that's a bit of a brain teaser.
And I hear my friend saying, well, gee, I'm not sure I'm going to vote for him. I'll probably vote for Fisker. It's like, why? Why are we going to vote for this guy? Give me one good reason, and they can't.
Speaking of which, when do the muni bond markets stop buying bonds from places like Chicago at any interest rate? You've got declining population, already high taxes, less ability to increase revenue to service the bonds. And if we don't make a change in the political leadership in the state and the city in the next in November and then in February and April, then it's only going to get worse. And there's not going to be another $180 billion in federal funding money that's being drop shipped to the state.
Well, I don't know if you're right about the last one. I mean, we've got a president who just said that we could just pass out money.
Well, we'll have a Republican Congress, so ostensibly.
That's true, I agree. Yeah, the last one. But that's been a mystery to me, you know, for the last 30 years. Why are people buying all these municipal bonds of these bankrupt cities and states? I mean, it never made much sense to me why people would buy a municipal bond at a 2 or 3% interest rate when you're buying a bond from an institution that probably doesn't have the money to repay it. And number two, who buys a bond at 3% interest? This is something that's mystified me. Why people were buying, it was just a year ago, the, 10-year bond was like less than 2%. I'm like, you're going to buy a bond at less than 2% interest rate? Do you think that inflation over the next 10 years is going to be less than 2%? And, I mean, I'm mystified how stupid people are to buy these bonds. And now you're seeing the bond rates go up and up and up, and that's going to cause huge problems for these cities. And, of course, that's why I think you're wrong, Dan. The only, rescue boat that is coming is Uncle Sam with more bailout money. But guess what? We're $4 trillion more in debt. We're running on empty here. And how can we bail out the cities? Well, we're bailing out for, do you see the number? $400 billion for student loans.
Mm-hmm. Well, just keep the printing presses running and then put Jay Powell on the job. That's all. That's what we've done the last 3 years. So let's stay in the markets for a second. I'm sure Karine Jean-Pierre today will take credit for the last 2 days of a market rebound, but which most people understand, who are in the market at least, understand it's just a lot of people rebalancing their portfolios after their that brutal month of September. But anyway, this is going to be perceived as, look, the ADP, if the ADP number is right out today, what the Labor Department says Friday, 208,000 new jobs, that exceeds street estimates, stock market rebound. We're on the road to recovery, Steve.
Yeah, boy, I wish that were so. I mean, by the way, the stock market since Biden came into office, even with the last 2 days, which have been amazing, we're still, the stock market's down about 13% since January.
And the NASDAQ's when down almost 30.
When you adjust for inflation, 13 to 15. Yeah, right, NASDAQ even more. So people have lost a lot of money in the market thanks to Biden. I don't have a good explanation for why we're seeing this debt. I suspect this is kind of a dead cat bounce right now because the world economy is in big, big trouble right now. You're seeing signs of layoffs and things like that. We probably will get another month of decent job numbers. But the other point is that the biggest problem for the U.S. economy right now, I believe, is we still have about 4 or 5 million Americans who should be working. And who are not. We don't know what happened to these people. They're just not working. And I was talking to my wife this morning. Have you tried to get a plumber? Have you tried to get an electrician? You tried to get somebody to, any kind of work these days? It's the most weirdest thing. We're paying people in Washington not to work. And guess what? They're not working. And that's causing economic chaos, I think, in this country. If you're going to get welfare, you got to work for it. Everybody's got to get working in this country if we're going to rebuild this economy.
He is Steve Moore, economist and author of Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, Dan, have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy is under the weather. She's not here today, so hopefully she'll be better and back soon, like tomorrow. We'll see. Our next guest, David Griesing, is the president and CEO of the Better Government Association, ironically entitled. He knows all about good journalism because he used to work for the Sun-Times. He wrote this about me and the newspapers that have created so much controversy among the elite journalists in Chicagoland and the Springfield Press Corps, too. Here's what he said about me and the papers that I'm sure you've received, many of you have read, we've discussed. Media message manipulator, that's me. Let's see what else we got here. Group, my pack, headed by Profta, failed political candidate turned Roger Stone knockoff, who left Illinois for Florida but keeps some of his media shenanigans parked here back home. People of goodwill can respect political views across the spectrum, but disdain for the truth, Prof's palette of choice is something we all need to call out, regardless of personal politics. That's me again. Prof's stable of demonstrably phony newspaper-looking leaflets has been dropped on doorsteps across northern Illinois, sort of like poison candy left in a bucket on the porch for unsuspecting trick-or-treaters, except the purpose of his ersatz info bombs is to poison the stomach, not the stomach, but the mind. Wow. It's a vivid metaphor. My pack is itself a non-truth. The basic tenet of my business strategy seems to be break any rule you see, according to David Griesing. And I'll be honest with readers, broken, adhere to the facts, broken, be a positive force in the community. The standard he holds everybody to, I'm sure, broken. My venture is a COVID-style contagion, one that does ill to all who come across it. No wonder he's so down on people wearing masks. Zing. The Prof is not limiting himself to printing broadsides on broadsheet either. His Twitter feed deals in racist-adjacent ramblings. Well, I mean, I'm not as smart as the journalists in town. Concede that point right off the gate. He refers to Illinois' bail reform law, the Safety Act, as Pritzker's Purge Law. This invokes the Purge series of movies that traffic in white nationalist anti-immigration tropes. Oh, heavens. In one of my retorts on my recent adjacent Twitter account, Griesing writes that I refer to Pritzker as Jay Belly, the apparent reference to Pritzker's plus size build. I'm glad that wasn't lost on him. Very classy, pure prof. Sure. Unlike being called a racist by Pritzker and everybody else. But that's not the legitimate. They're ad hominem, like you're hearing throughout Griesing's column. It's legitimate, of course. They're just describing what is. Me, I'm classless. Sure. His leaflets undermine the tenets of political dialogue and the damage they do to our democracy. Our entire democracy. Wow. Becoming more evident as time goes on. The pandemic has taught us anything. It's that virulent viruses mutate, but real reporting can stand in contrast and expose Prof's costume content for the counterfeit concoction it is. Wonderful alliteration. High marks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you get the sense of it. I'm not exactly sure what Griesing's trying to say, but I guess the papers are upsetting him. So let's look at the latest edition, shall we? Here are the stories. This is from the September 18th to 24th edition. The front page story, Chicago investigation, 165K suspicious employers get $2.3 billion in PPP loans. We talked about in this show, this is an analysis of data that was released by the U.S. Small Business Administration, just looking at the SBA loan size and number across neighborhoods in Chicago, regions of the state. Will County property taxes near tops in the count in the country. And then we have a grid inside of the effective property tax rates in Will County and compare them to state property tax rates, including Illinois. Yes, boy, this is pretty disgusting stuff. I can see DeVore, Pritzker private payments to staff violate Illinois gift ban act. Tom DeVore, the Republican nominee for attorney general, arguing that Pritzker's personal payment of state workers in his office is violative of the gift ban act. It's just an argument, legal argument he's made. Okay. On the inside, Governor Pritzker deserves no credit for his taxpayer relief plan for Illinois. That's an op-ed by Ted Dabrowski at Wire Points. It's labeled an opinion piece. It's outrageous. Yeah. There's a piece on Catalina Lauf, who's running for Congress out west against Bill Foster. There's a reprint of press releases from Plainfield and Joliet as regarding their pride fests. Then there's some of the impact on inflation in terms of the cost for Chicago's middle class by category, like energy and groceries and rent and so forth. Uh-huh. And then there's, some events in Will County, because this is a Will County edition, and there's athletes in action. Yeah, it's the horrors of it. Wow. For police to now be joined by David Griesing. He's the president and CEO of the, as I said, ironically entitled Better Government Association. David, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I can tell you're happy to have me, Dan. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So the Will County Gazette, I just went through the stories, one of my papers. Which of those stories contains falsities, misinformation, is poison candy on the doorstep?
Dan, the entire premise of the publication is what the falsehood is. It presents itself as a newspaper when, in fact, it is fair political speech. And it doesn't abide by any of the conventions of honest journalism, i.e. Balanced reporting. In its selection of stories, it distorts the news. Articles in your papers routinely imply that the Safety Act provisions with regard to no cash bail are in effect right now, and in fact, we all know they are not.
That does nothing of the sort. But go ahead.
And so, what I am objecting to in this column is the fact that you're distributing really broadsheet campaign leaflets. You have every right to do that. That's free speech in the U.S. But to do so under the pretext of something that looks and feels and nearly reads like a news organ is, I think, misleading, and therein lies the falsehoods that I refer to. And there are specific falsehoods in individual articles, but
please,
I'm not going to go into those details.
No, of course not. Why? You don't need to when you just can do a generic hit piece on me personally and the papers generally. You just can racist adjacent and so on and so forth and all these standards you apply unevenly. But I understand. I mean, you're somebody who's voted in 8 Democrat primaries and 0 Republicans. So like most of the press corps here, we appreciate your perspective and where you're coming from. We know your politics. But why not offer specifics? It seems to me that's the easiest way to prove your point so that you don't need to be reading tea leaves and asserting implications. You can just say straight away, this is something right here in this story that is inaccurate, that is misinformation. But you won't want to do that, even though you say you have specifics. So why not share them?
Okay, just to take one, September 30th, 2022, an article by Ben Gonzalez. Oh, my God, assault ad, a non-detainable offense under Pritzker's purge law, shows the beating of a person on a train, again, playing to fear and such. In the text of the story, it states that these provisions are in effect, and then it makes reference for authority to a Will County Gazette article that also is just an opinion piece, essentially, with regard to the Safety Act. So the story is constructed to be misleading, and the some of the specifics with regard to no cash bail are not accurate.
That beating, that aggravated assault for which that individual is charged, is absolutely a non-detainable offense under the Safety Act, which would take effect January 1 if it's not enjoined by courts.
And
it's de facto in effect under Kim Fox in Cook County, which is what we've been saying, which I've been saying on the radio. We've been talking about this in the context of January 1 because we've been talking about the election in the context of the November 8th election, in the context of January 1, this is your opportunity to get new leadership in Illinois that would try to do something about the Safety Act before it takes effect. So that's just specious. Talk about idiosyncratic implications when you know exactly what the entire conversation is. For me, I just had an op-ed in the Tribune right after yours about the Safety Act, citing all these Democrat state's attorneys, providing chapter and verse on their problems with it, as we've had any number of state's attorneys and sheriffs on this show and elsewhere in the conversation. So that is just so disingenuous to suggest that we are suggesting something that we're not, that it's in effect, except de facto under Kim Fox, when we're arguing this entire time about this being a referendum question on the November ballot.
Well, and I'm reading the way that you present these stories as disingenuous, indeed. So we're reading what you published differently because of the strong implications in your stories that the provisions are in effect now, and they're not, and we both know that.
And that's
fine. You're entitled to twist the truth in political statements.
Right.
But what I think is misleading and should not be part of the conversation is presenting this information as if it is objective journalism and in the form.
There's no such thing as objective journalism. That in itself is a fraud. A fraudulent premise from which you start. Is the Sun-Times, is that objective journalism? Is the Tribune objective journalism? You mean the reporters there bring nothing to the table? They are objective oracles of truth. They have no personal opinions on anything that influence their coverage. If you believe that, then let me just ask you this question, which I ask all the time. I'd be curious to hear your answer. Since we know that basically 88% to 94% of the Chicago press corps, the DC press corps vote for the Democrat candidate for president. That's from Gallup survey research every year since 64, since they've been surveying it. Let me ask you, if the reverse were true, if 88% to 94% of the press corps had been voting for the Republican candidate for president for the last 50 years, let's say, do you think the coverage in these newspapers, including the Tribune, your former employer, the Sun-Times, you think it would be any different? Or they're so objective, it wouldn't matter?
First of all, I also worked for the Chicago Tribune.
Good
I worked
for
Business Week, and I worked for Reuters.
Would it be different?
So I'm not sure why you're just selecting
all of the above. AFL-CIO Times, okay. They have no political agenda.
Event,
I know the AFL-CIO has no political agenda. AFL-CIO Times.
Yeah.
The entirety of it. What's the answer?
The Sun-Times, when I worked there, was owned by Rupert Murdoch, not by the union. So
The idea is you would never go after the Sun-Times for being owned by the AFL-CIO or NPR because they have no political agenda. Those are objective journalists. But regardless, take all of your outlets that you've ever worked for and all the outlets in the country. What is the answer to the question? Would the coverage be different if 90% of journalists were Republican primary voters instead of Democrat? Do you think it'd be different?
Okay. First of all, just for your information, perhaps you're not aware, the Sun-Times is no longer owned by controlled by the AFL-CIO.
NPR.
They no longer have an investment interest. Just so your listeners are aware,
NPR.
They're now a nonprofit. But in
NPR,
any event,
right. Also objective.
I get the way you're trying to paint me with.
Just answer the question.
But in any event, Dan, to answer your question. There is an effort. I can accept your premise that there's no such thing as objectivity.
Well, then
that's
stop saying
evident,
it.
For example, in these newsletters, these flyers in broadsheet that you print.
We don't pretend to be objective. We don't lie. You're lying when you say objective, and you just conceded you were.
I'm saying that traditional journalism seeks objectivity, seeks fair comment, balance in its reporting. I don't see in any of the articles I read in your broadsheet pamphlets, do I see any effort whatsoever to tell both sides of the story.
You can't see anything. You can't see things you don't want to see.
A selection of facts and a misrepresentation that
how long have you been reading the papers?
Editorial policy seek to do. You have the right to publish this.
How long have you been reading the papers?
Since the first one landed on my door, exactly how long ago.
So you'd be surprised to learn that these outlets have existed for the last 7 years.
Good for you. Congratulations. Not bad.
Right. So these outlets have existed.
When did you start distributing them so broadly? All of a sudden they're showing up in where I live.
We've mailed them out intermittently, depending on how well finances are going. But regardless, the last 7 years they've existed, the entire Chicago and Springfield press corps has known about them because they've criticized us before, because of course they have. And so now all you folks have reaffixed the scales to your eyes and now are coming to the papers here in this election cycle and saying, oh my God, look at these papers that have been around for 7 years and we've previously commented on, but now we're going to pretend like this is sui generis and we knew nothing about it. Very, very, well, very straightforward. Very objective.
I can tell you, I was not aware of what you were doing. I wish I had known earlier. Maybe I could have warned readers earlier that these are look like newspapers. They're not. They're
right.
Political pamphlets.
Exactly.
They're really effectively constructed political pamphlets. I might compliment you on that. They definitely present a point of view in the guise of objective reporting.
No. There's no guise because we don't pretend to be objective. We never said we're objective. If you look at our About Us statement, we explicitly say that. We explicitly said what I just effectively repeated, that we don't defraud people by pretending to be objective. We have a point of view. We want to advance stories that are not covered and stories that are not covered from the angles we cover them because we have a point of view about public policy. And people like you and the outlets you work for, all of them pretend that they don't have a point of view and they have no interest in the outcomes of public policy discussions. And that's a lie. And that's the difference between us. David Griesing, President, Chief Executive of the BGA. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. And you join us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy's under the weather, so hopefully she'll be better and back soon, soon as tomorrow. We'll see. The curse of the miserable older white woman. This got my attention. Sort of a favorite topic. Dichotomy that's presented by the author. For the left, the privileged lady wrangling a prescription for her non-problems can be blamed for all of society's woes, racism, imperialism, the housing shortage, the cost of living, climate change, perhaps even monkeypox. Her antidepressant usage can be categorized as yet another indulgence she engages in while other people suffer, akin to day at the spa. White women live off Starbucks and antidepressants. The left-produced character lives in a large suburban house with a rich husband and resents her perfect life. Excess red wine, antidepressants, free time, and money has truly done wonders to boomer white women. This is a woman whose problem is that she has it too good. If she had to deal with the same adversity as everyone else, this would build character and she'd stop the whining. And that's what she says, you know, from the left's perspective, angst with the quote-unquote miserable older white woman, which she needs to trademark. Because it's in first letter caps. So this is a thing. Now for the right, here's her characterization of the right's characterization of the miserable older white woman. It's the opposition for the right. Democratic Party supporters are self-hating, college-educated white women. Basically, if you live in an apartment in L.A. and own four cats, a massive sex toy, and consume a lot of antidepressants, you're a Democratic Party voter. Is that inaccurate? And she is getting her comeuppance for her decades of liberalism. She foolishly bought into the feminist myth that women have brains and should have high-powered careers. And look at her now, all alone with her cats, pining for the life she could have had if she'd settled down when still turning heads. Not sure about that, but they're fun characterizations to explore further. So we're pleased to be joined by Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, the author of The Perils of Privilege, in quotation marks, co-host of the Feminine Chaos podcast, and the author of that piece over at unheard.com that I was reading from. Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. So some of those characterizations were, those were actually tweets.
Somewhere in quotation marks. Right.
Just to be clear that this wasn't me, That was not exactly how I would have put it, the thing about the Los Angeles. I've lived in Chicago, but never Los Angeles. I don't give it much.
That part of it was in quotation marks. So, yeah, there's tweets that are, you know, that you fill out, as it were. So for these caricatures. So what then is the synthesis of these two competing viewpoints in your view? Is the miserable older white women, in quotes, an unfair characterization of the 50 plus white women out there?
I don't think it makes any sense. I don't think it has much to do with actual white women. I don't think it has much to do with actual people. I think what I've noticed, though, and this is even in my book, The Perils of Privilege, which came out in 2017, I was already writing about this, but it's become even more the case lately, is that older white women have become kind of a punching bag for the left and the right for different but converging reasons. You saw this a lot with the whole Karen cliche,
right,
especially during COVID, where Karen could be an anti-vaxxer. Karen could also be the woman insisting everybody wear a mask. It didn't really matter. Karen was just any woman who's being annoying. It could be that she's racist. It could be that she's just annoying, right? It didn't really matter. Karen was just the person everybody hated for different reasons. As for the characterization, I mean, well-educated women these days are getting married and having children. So this sort of cliche of the career woman who doesn't settle down is kind of outdated. So just in terms of demographics, I'm not sure that it actually adds up either.
Well, no, there's no question about it. I mean, Charles Murray wrote about that in Coming Apart. The problem with the rich and the rich enclaves is they don't preach what they practice. What they practice is getting married and having kids and having a family. What they preach is rationalizations for people who make, well, less productive choices, one would argue, based on outcomes one think has a pretty good argument to make. So I don't think that's it. I think so much of it, whether you're single or whether you're, you know, part of the Chardonnay Antifa, there I go again, advancing a cartoonish caricature, you know, the wine mom thing. Whether you're in that, whether you're single, career, or career or no career, married or I shouldn't wait, whether you're single or married, and then career or no career. I mean, the real divide among women is married women versus single women in terms of their voting patterns. We know that. And then there's sort of a subset of married women that live in rich enclaves who tend to be more to the left. And I think that's where the right zeroes in. It zeroes in on the family disintegration that leads to people being more dependent on the state and thus more inclined to the left. And then those who somehow feel guilty about their status or their wealth and live in rich areas. And so sort of vote or move to the left based on some sort of, I would characterize it as neo white man's burden type thinking.
Well, I think the left and the right both make fair criticisms here, but I guess it depends on which life stage. So I think that the left has been wrong in saying that, you know, there's something terrible about settling down before 30 or something like this, because, you know, biology being what it is, most women are going to have to, if they do want to have, you know, their own biological children, which most women and most people do, it can't really be that you start thinking about this, you can't start thinking about this at 35, as I think is how I think Helen Andrews has said. That's, I think, a fair criticism. However, I think that where the left is right is that basically you can't really, a woman can't truly, like, even if you want to stay home and be a stay-at-home mother when your children are very small, most women are going to both want to and financially have to work, you know, for many, many of their adult years after this, right? So before and after this, probably, but certainly after this, if they're having children young. And this idea that, you know, women should just kind of think about, like, the household, the family, all of this, it's only temporarily going to work. Like, I don't get the sense that the kind of traditionalist trad, you know, mindset has really thought through what a woman whose child is 7, whose child is 9, or whose children are, you know, 7 and 9, whatever, what is she doing during the day? I don't think they've thought that through. And they also, I don't think, have thought through who's paying for all of this in terms of whether it's childcare help, health insurance, things like that.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. So one is what they choose to do, and one is what they have to do in order to make ends meet. And there's a larger conversation about the need to have two income families in order to make ends meet in 21st century America in a way that wasn't the case 60 or 70 years ago. But so that's a definitely a deeper conversation. But even for even setting that aside, yeah, I think the issue is the whole, and by the way, even like Madeleine Albright and some second wave feminists, maybe like Camille Paglia, have said this too. Sure, women can have it all, but just like most people, they can't have it all necessarily at the same time. You know, life is trade-offs. And so sometimes making a choice forecloses making another choice, at least for the moment. And that sort of nuance in the conversation about having it all, in quotation marks, it often seems to be lost to me.
I think so, although I think there are things that can make it a whole lot easier. So I'm American, but I live in Toronto, in Canada, and I will say that I know plenty of women who have careers and children. I have two small children myself, so I'm in that world.
Well, of course.
I think there are practical things that help here, which is that, you know, women will very frequently take a year of maternity leave when they have a baby. And to go to the doctor here, you just go. There's no copay. There's universal health care here. So it's just, it's not just about the money, because if you have health insurance in the States, that can go great. But, you know, it's just the hassle. It's just things are very easy here in certain key ways that do, I think, facilitate this sort of having it all situation. Now, I know that there are, like the writer Tara Henley, she's Canadian, and she's written about how women in Canada can't have it all. So I know that some of these critiques hold here too, but I think there are certain practical things governments can do to make it a little easier.
What about, I mean, you know, the sort of the balance here too. I mean, the status of men and boys, actually David Brooks wrote about this recently in the New York Times. He's hardly the first one to opine on this or to offer this expression of concern. One in three American men with only a high school diploma, that's 10 million men, are out of the labor force. That's a problem. The biggest drop in employment is among young men, 25 to 34. Men are also struggling physically. 3 out of every 4 deaths of despair, suicide and drug overdoses, men. For every 100 middle-aged women who died of COVID, there were 184 middle-aged men who died of COVID. He also references Richard Reeves's new book of Boys and Men. He notes from Reeves's research, boys much more hindered by challenging environments than girls. Girls in poor neighborhoods and unstable families may be able to climb their way out. Boys are less likely to do so. In Canada, boys born into the poorest households are twice as likely to remain poor as their female counterparts. In America, in American schools, boys' academic performance is more influenced by family background than girls' performance, and so on and so forth. So it's just sort of interesting. I mean, I don't want to pit men versus women. That's sort of what the, you know, modern feminists do, and those on the left. But I mean, and we see this in other ways of measuring likelihood of success, independence, financial wherewithal, like women are earning BAs and advanced degrees in almost every subject other than computer science and a couple of the engineering disciplines than men, that that you've got a real problem here with what's happening to men and boys. And sort of that needs to be folded in the conversation, because it turns out women are the moms of and grandmas of men and boys. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. But it's interesting to learn that. Yeah, so I read that David Brooks article, and I'd like to read the Richard Reeves book also. I haven't yet read it. But yeah, so I have some thoughts about that, which is that basically I think that there has been a strand of feminism, not all of feminism, but some of it, has been very much about this idea, and I think I even tweeted about this, that sort of that it's emotional labor when a mother has to, you know, like plan, you know, lunch or something, you know, and it's like making a big fuss about like things that are just kind of like people doing things for their family, which everybody does, you know, and that has kind of presented it rather than that there are systemic problems that hurt women specifically, which there still are in this world. And I could get into that, but that basically it's always that women have it harder than men. There's been a strand of feminism that kind of makes that argument. And I think that what's happened is I think there's been kind of a cultural pushback, including from progressives, saying like, wait a second, that's not the case in every individual circumstance. And there are, you know, other systemic situations where, you know, other areas like education where maybe women and girls have it easier than men and boys. However, I would say that I think there's something I would want to look a little more closely at the numbers and so forth, because I think a lot of the time when women are doing well in higher education, it's not necessarily translating to financial success or stability. Often it does, but often it doesn't. And it depends, because you have to look at what, like, let's say there are a lot of women with master's degrees. What are they master's degrees in?
Well, sure.
And how much debt do they have?
So, sure, absolutely. Well, that's with men or women. I mean, if you're right, if you're going to get a master's in art history, you're probably going to do less well financially than a master's in finance. I mean, that's anybody.
Well, exactly. But the point is that if you're saying, like, oh no, where are all the men at this master's degree ceremony? And I have a PhD, so I was at a ceremony where I saw, you know, like, all the people going up to get their master's degrees, many, many people, you know, getting master's degrees. And yes, you see a lot of, it's going to be a lot of women in fields where, you know, you'll see on paper, okay, women are doing better in higher education than men, but what did it actually mean? And the man who didn't get that degree also doesn't have that debt.
Well, right. Choices, you know, I mean, yeah, that's well, yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I mean, right. So some stuff, look, the man who didn't get that degree, who didn't get any degree and went to work, you know, on an oil rig or went to work as a trucker at 18 is going to be doing a lot better at 25 or 30 than a lot of college graduates. There's no question, you know. So, I mean, this is why I say choices.
This is why I think that this question of boys and men falling behind, I would need to read more about this. And
yeah.
I actually intend to figure out kind of what's going on here, because I think a lot of the time, and then it, as I'm hardly the first to point out, you know, a lot of this is this issue where, so there are two things happening, right? There is, on the one hand, when the economy is set up to assume two incomes, it, you know, changes what everything costs. But there's also the fact that when women enter a field, it often becomes sort of associated with femininity and treated as kind of a less serious thing and perhaps less compensated. So I think it's complicated.
Mm-hmm. She is Phoebe Maltz Bovey. She's the author of The Perils of Privilege. She's also the co-host of the Feminine Chaos podcast. And you can check out her column on her.com. The Curse of Miserable Older White Women. Phoebe, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And she joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.